Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, John Karsibayev.
Hi, my name is Sandy Carter, and I'm Amazon Web Services Vice President for our WWPS Partners and Programs.
Sandy, thanks so much for making time to join us on the Ivy Podcast. Before we dive in and talk a little bit further about your current role, what falls under your purview, give us a thumbnail version of your career to date.
Sure. And John, thank you so much for having me on. I have been what I would call a business leader with a focus on technology for quite some time. I've worn multiple leadership hats. I worked at IBM and I ran our cloud and AI and ML ecosystem work. I ran my own startup for a while in Silicon Valley, working on a MVP for how a company could look at its innovation, kind of like a Myers-Briggs, to do its personality or its culture matching with some tactics. And currently, as I said, I'm a vice president here at AWS, and I focus on a lot of our partners and programs globally around the world. And so that includes many industries like healthcare and space, government, education, some energy work we do, as well as state and local government, and you name it. A lot of the regulated industries are what we work on.
Well, that's super exciting. And thanks for that background. Sounds like a very diverse and exciting career you've had so far. I can relate on so many levels, being a founder of a startup of my own, multiple startups, most of which I had successfully failed, but you know, had a decent outcome with one. But the overall experience of going through the journey, I think it's no other school can ever teach that. So from that standpoint, tell us a little bit more about that transition going from building your startup, the MVP, I would imagine working with a lot of other partners and customers. And how did that help you transition successfully into your current position?
Oh, well, it was an amazing school, as you described it as well. It taught me a lot. And because I, you know, really tried to learn a lot and was very curious, I had a great education, because when I came to AWS is essentially one big startup. We run what we call the two pizza teams, which really breaks all the problems into small startup communities that get funding and, you know, kind of work empowered and linked together, but still independently. And so there really was no better learning for me before I came to AWS than to be part of a startup, for sure.
Well, that brings so many memories, especially through the early days when you decide to, you know, find that product market fit. You gather as much feedback from your customers as possible, which, you know, I can see a lot of similarities on how that actually translates to a corporate environment. So with in your current role as the head of partnerships at AWS, tell us a little bit more about, you know, in more detail in terms of what falls under your purview.
Yeah, so I have a great pleasure to work with all different types of partners. So we have consulting partners, like I just had dinner with Deloitte last night. We've got ISV partners, or partners who produce software. So think about Splunk or Salesforce, Esri, Palantir, as well as distributors, resellers, and startups. So I get to help startups now. As I started to mention, we work across multiple industries. So government, healthcare, education, nonprofit, space, which is a really hot area now. A lot of the regulated industries as well. So we just announced an energy accelerator, for example. And for these partners, our goal is to help them grow their business, add more value to their customers, drive their cloud adoption, and really help facilitate the creation of mission-critical cloud solutions with them. We've seen some really nice success so far. So if you think about, excuse me, our year-over-year success, we've grown our business more than double-digit, 45%. year over year with companies joining our program and wanting to be part of our AWS family.
Well, that's very interesting. And I'll tell you one thing, I am a customer of AWS. Both of my companies are currently hosted on AWS, and we've had nothing but a very pleasant experience, especially when it came to onboarding and getting things started as a startup and trying to scale and build something that's sustainable for that growth that we're projecting. So a lot of things that, you know, we could probably spend the rest of the podcast talking about. But in terms of when it comes to innovation, you know, with a company such a major brand as Amazon, I'm curious in terms of building and fostering that environment of innovation. That topic fascinates me at so many levels. I'm curious to hear a little bit more from your perspective, from an established environment as such. How do you come in and actually continue foster and develop such environment of innovation? What are the different practical recommendations you may have that really helped you succeed in that spectrum?
Well, I find, you know, Amazon is kind of the king or queen of innovation. And so I've learned a lot working at Amazon on the mechanisms that they have in place to drive innovation and to monetize it. So just a couple of things, John, I'll throw out there that really help you to build and foster that culture of innovation. One is we do have these two pizza teams I mentioned earlier. The teams, we call it a two pizza team because the teams are small enough to where if you had to work late one night, that team would only have to order two pizzas for dinner. We don't want any teams bigger than that. And so what that does is it empowers the team. They're able to go off and make their own decisions. They can move very rapidly. They obtain funding, much like I did as a head of my startup company. We pitch an idea based on the merits of the idea. You get funding or no funding. We have a strict methodology for decision making. And this was probably one of the hardest things that I had to learn. You know, some companies I worked for in the past, everything was really slow decision because you had to get collaboration from everybody. But as a startup, you know, you're making every decision really fast. Amazon really differentiates between the two types of decision making, a one-way door and a two-way door. A two-way door is a decision that you make. And if you make it, you can make it really fast because it can be quickly reversed. So let's say, you know, maybe you're going to change your website to have blue as a feature color, to have orange as a feature color. That's a decision you could just make and move and go because, hey, if the customers don't like it, you can switch it back and there's no harm, no foul. But if you're making a really big decision, we call that a one-way door. Let's say you're going to change an API for your developers. Well, once you do that, it impacts all those developers, all those applications. It's hard to take it back. And so we really pause and we're very thoughtful as we make decisions that are one-way door decisions. So in your day, Amazon estimates that about 80% of your decisions will be two-way door. So they expect you to go fast, 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 fast until you run upon one of those one-way door decisions. And then you have to pause and think and really collaborate a lot more, get a lot more consensus, a lot more ideas as well. The other big thing we do around innovation is we do something called working backwards in a PRFAQ process. So what does that mean? We always, always, always start with a customer and we have to know who the customer is, really understand the depth of the customer. And it can't be, you know, my customer is this company. It's a person and a role within the company. And then we work backwards from them. And before we even write a single line of code, John, we write a press release. Like, what do we want the outcome to be? What would that look like? And then we have, backing that press release up, we have a set of frequently asked questions. And I thought, you know, hey, when I came in, I could do this pretty easy because I'll make up my own frequently asked questions. But you're not allowed to do that. You have a set of questions like, hey, you went to dinner last night with a partner. And what did they say about what you just did? What was the best thing that they loved about it? Or, hey, you went for drinks and your customer hated something. What was that one thing that they said they hated? And so we spend a lot of time thinking through this. In some cases, we actually reverse what we're doing because we don't like that one thing that someone would say about, you know, the product or the experience or something like that. So for me, these are just some of the things that I learned from Amazon about how to not just have a one hit wonder, but to really create mechanisms to recreate the success that you had with innovating as well. I love it.
Well, those are some very fascinating frameworks. I was taking notes here myself very viciously. From the two pizza to one, the two-way doors to PR, FAQ. I love these, which resonates on so many levels with the environment that I'm currently operating under. And I recently made a post on LinkedIn about something of a similar framework where instead of going, you know, the thought was all of the big plans are a form of procrastination. Where instead, especially when you're trying to build an MVP or some type of a version of a product, instead of going after that big vision, focus on something. What is a 1 week version of that product? What is a 1 month version of that product? Or what is even 1 hour version of this product? And try to decompose that vision into something more, a little bit more manageable and iterative. I think that resonates on so many levels where you've mentioned even before you write a single line of code, you write a press release along with the frequently asked questions. I think that just creates a completely different mindset or framework in terms of what to invest in and what to build further. So I really appreciated that.
The other thing, John, I didn't add, but you kind of brought it up when you talk about, you know, what would you build the first month, the second month? But, you know, at Amazon, we don't build MVPs, we build MLPs, a minimum lovable product. And what do we mean by that? We want a version of a product with just enough features to be usable by early customers who can provide some feedback on that so we can do development better. But we use MLP, minimum lovable product, instead because we do want people, customers, to love the experience. An MVP kind of implies that it's not the best. It's just like the minimum viability. But it really does have to be lovable or a customer's not going to adopt it. So we really changed our standards for how we're thinking about a product or that initial thought because we were sliding towards a standard that was too low. And so that also made all the difference in the world. In fact, when I had my startup, I think we did build an MLP, not an MVP, because our product was really loved by, many of our customers.
Wow. I love that. I'm going to have to steal that from you because it makes perfect sense. When it comes to viability and, from lovable perspective, because if you're delighting your customers, if you're really operating in that mindset, whether you are a painkiller or are you a vitamin, in the sense that you provide that experience to your customers, I think that puts a completely different mindset, as you said it, when it comes to building that initial version of a product. Is it going to be lovable and things like that? So, Claire, I definitely appreciated those frameworks, which, at least to me, they're very valuable. So another trend, that I've been very fascinated about, and before I get into that, the whole concept of future of work, I wanted to ask you on a broader scale, what are the different trends and ideas that you're personally very excited about, very passionate? What are you tinkering with, nights and weekends when you're not working? Give us a little bit of a glimpse into that.
Yeah. So I kind of tend to think in terms of three. So let me kind of tell you what I'm thinking about a lot of recently. So the first one, and I think many people are thinking of this because of COVID, but it's really about the future of work. Like, what does work look like, in the next 3 to 5 years? I really love something I read that said, the future of work has to move from comfort to connection, to contribution. And Deloitte actually just did a survey and they said that 93% of workers said that sense of belonging is what's gonna keep them at a company. It's what gives them purpose. So I'm spending a lot of time thinking about what does that look like? What does hybrid look like? When everybody's at home and everybody's on Zoom, It's kind of easy because you're all on video. When everybody's in the office interacting in a room, it's kind of easy. When you have that mixed media, you have some people on the phone, some people in the room, it gets more challenging. So how do you do that hybrid work? So there's just a lot of questions and things that I'm thinking about in that future of work. The second thing that I've really been thinking about is the power of artificial intelligence and machine learning. So we're seeing a much greater adoption of AI and ML. In fact, we just released a rapid adoption, kind of a working session for our partners to help them envision what problems AI ML might help them to solve immediately, what that looks like, and to help them build that first prototype. So, you know, we're seeing, we launched a healthcare accelerator, people wanting to figure out a cure for cancer, to simple automation, figuring and sorting that out, to, you know, detecting ransomware, which is a really hot topic today. So I've been spending a lot of time thinking about the power of AI and ML, the ethics around AI and ML, and some of the new challenges that it's going to bring up as well. And some of them are really far out there, like, you know, what really is a human? Could a computer be declared a human, for example, and all of the ethics that go around that? And then the third thing that I've been spending a lot of time thinking about is space. My team just announced a space accelerator. We got an accelerator, for those of you who don't know, is a way that you can help a startup accelerate their scale journey. And so we partnered with Seraphim, which is an accelerator that only does space. And we had AWS step in. We've got some of the best space minds in the world, like Clint Crozier. And we set up a 4-week continuum so that we were teaching the startups not just about our subject matter expertise in space with Seraphim, but also AWS and some of the possibilities there. We thought, John, that we would get applicants mostly from the US, but we got applicants from 44 different countries. Wow. Yesterday, we did a session on space, and it was really interesting because we selected, out of all the different startups, we selected a cohort of 10 to really focus in on. And, you know, what they're doing is not just impactful to space, but some of the content that they're gathering, the data can help us with climate. Climate issues could potentially help us with sustainability. So for instance, yesterday we had a discussion about protein-based foods and when would the U.S. run out of the capability to have enough protein-based foods on the U.S. and what could we do in space to supplement that? So I know it's a little bit long answer, but those are the three trends that really excite me: future of work, power of AI and ML, and then space, the potential of space.
Well, those are very fascinating. And you beat me to that. When it comes to future of work, it's something, you know, I definitely share that with you. It's a fascinating concept that I've been following and studying for the last couple of years, you know, with the insurgence of the contingent workforce, coming out of the pandemic and how that actually changes the behavior of, you know, not only from a talent acquisition perspective, but from talent retention, which was very interesting when you've mentioned that study by Deloitte when it comes to some of the factors that are really going to drive a lot of the employee behavior staying within the companies when it comes to that sense of belonging. So that leads me to the further, you know, question that I wanted to ask you. With the current market conditions, the war for talent has been real out there, especially in the technology sector. But there's another layer to that, on the retention side, and for companies maybe with not such a recognizable brand as Amazon. And I spent a lot of time talking to other executives at all kinds of different sizes of companies. And this has been one of the most prevalent topics, I want to say, in the past year. What are other executives doing at their organizations to really, you know, build that environment, not so much over retention, but where the employees have the right ecosystem to not only think about the future opportunities, but grow within the current roles that they currently serve. Can you share some thoughts that you may have around retention? What are some of the areas that really help you succeed in that area?
Yeah, I think that, you know, the interesting thing is that nobody had a playbook for what we just went through, right, John? I mean, who would have ever thought we would have had such a global pandemic? And, you know, it even continues today, right? It's not over. And mm-hmm. So, you know, you kind of had to make it up as you went, experiment, kind of like you do as a startup, right? So for example, you know, given that comfort, you know, if you think about future of work is about comfort, connection, and contribution. So in terms of comfort, you know, we decided since people had to work from home and we wanted to retain those people, we need to make their home office as comfortable as possible. So Amazon, along with a lot of other companies, made their home office really comfortable. You know, I have a standing desk. I've got a great desk chair. I've got a ring light for when I'm doing video, not just audio like we're doing today. You know, making it comfortable, designing work for well-being so employees can live and perform at their very, very best. I think that's really important. And maybe it doesn't directly relate to retention, but it definitely has an impact on that to support employees' health and well-being. In fact, this morning, I was reading one of the articles and it said that 66% of employees now expect a company to help them deal with the mental challenges, the mental stress that has resulted from COVID. You know, we're seeing people afraid to come back into work, want to go back into work too much. I mean, there's just so many different things. So I think first is just dealing with that comfort area, that well-being area that's really important. I think the second area is connection, right? I mean, if you think back, John, on your best jobs, they're where you connected with your boss. You connected with the team you're working on. You guys felt a common, you know, vision. And so you have to build new ways to connect. So I tried a bunch of things out. We did virtual wine tasting. Since people were working so much at home, we did this was really cool. We had a virtual zoo tour. So we had this lady, she had a Go camera. We invited my team and their families to come in and we did this virtual zoo tour. It was super cool. And so since you're virtual, you have to figure out new ways to connect, right? We have a virtual trivia game. So we're trying to experiment with things that might work. I did a daily stand-up called The New Normal. It was like my virtual water cooler. So you're not allowed to talk about work in our new normal call. You come in and you can talk about the weekend. You can talk about your kids or, you know, like we have one guy getting married on my team. You can talk about all of that, but you can't come in and talk about work. And different people show up. We did it every day. Different people show up. Today, we had a really interesting discussion about, again, kind of work-related, but not really, but what are your fears about, you know, now going back to the old normal? Like, what are your fears about that? So I think building connection is another really important point about retention. And then the biggest one, the one you kind of started with, was that contribution, that you have meaning for work and you have purpose. You know, Amazon's motto is work hard, have fun, and change history. And that change history part is what attracts so many people to our business because everybody wants to change history. They want to do something that's phenomenal. When we announced our space accelerator, John, you would not believe how many resumes came in wanting to work on our team because of that. Or, you know, we did a focus on health and how many people want to help digital transform healthcare into something that's really meaningful and helpful. And so I think it's those three things. I think it's comfort or well-being, that connection, engagement, and that contribution that really helps that retention area.
I love how you compartmentalized such a complex question into a very easily digestible format from that triple C perspective, comfort, connection, and contribution. And those examples, I think they resonate on so many levels. I love the framework of no work, daily stand-up. I think that's very fascinating. It seems so simple, but oftentimes overlooked concept, where you know you take into account all of the Zoom fatigues and the work-life balance and everything that we had to deal with, especially in the past year. And you know, simple things like that, I think they contribute to that comfort and connection perspective, where you were able to build that medium to continue that interaction with your peers, with your colleagues and employees on so many levels, where you had that opportunity when we were physically located, you know, in the offices. So those are very fascinating concepts. I definitely appreciated that. When it comes to interviewing, it's an area that I'm yet to see anyone be really, really good at. It's a combination of art and a science. It's very challenging as well. It's very difficult, and it's a skill that continues to evolve, at least for me. I study this very extensively. One book that really resonates with me is by Ben Horowitz, The Hard Thing About the Hard Things, where he made a framework of hiring for strength versus the lack of weakness. Because I do agree that a lot of times, when at least in the past when I was interviewing, you directly or indirectly look for those areas. Can I tolerate that weakness in that particular candidate? So those are the areas that you know I've been studying, researching a lot. Share with us your frameworks or your thoughts overall on how to succeed or increase your batting average when it comes to interviewing.
Yeah, that's another really good one, right? Because if you're going to retain people, you need to hire the right people. So I think that people don't sit down and think about first who they really want to hire. So at Amazon, we're always working backwards from the customer. And our customers tend to be builders, right? Because the cloud, as you said, you used Amazon Web Services to build this, to build that. And so we're looking for builders. So everything that we target in the way we go after people, we want people who want to build. And we let them kind of say, what does build mean, right? Build can mean I'm a marketeer and I want to build like the best event possible. Or it could be I want to build the best service. And so we purposely target the type of people with the type of attitude or culture that they possess first and foremost, which I think is really important when you're recruiting. Amazon also believes in a behavioral interview. So we do two phone screens to ensure, John, that you have the functional skills. But what we're really looking for is, will you fit with the culture, the builder culture? And so our questions start with, you know, tell me about a time when, or give me an example of, and by having you share an example from your past, we then deduce how you might perform on the job in the future. So for example, we might say, hey, John, tell me about a time when you took a calculated risk, or tell me an example of your proudest, most professional achievement. Or when did you have to leave a task unfinished? How did you decide to leave that task unfinished? And how did you prioritize? And so what we're looking for then is data points from those answers to the behavioral-based questions that demonstrate our leadership principles. And our leadership principles are something we live every day. They're not something that's just up on a wall. There are things like customer obsession, bias for action, earning trust, and the depth of the response shows your ability to deep dive clearly on a complex subject. So as we do the interview, that's what we're looking for as we're thinking about how we select that person. We also do something called the loop. So as a hiring manager, I can't just hire anyone. We have a bar raiser who's always looking to raise the talent bar, and the hiring manager, and then a team of people. And we all get together, and the bar raiser and the hiring manager both have to agree before we hire the person. And the team provides us feedback, and they really talk about this person had good customer obsession or really great ability to reinvent and simplify. So they go and they rate the candidate based on those, that criteria. So it's really important if you're going to interview for Amazon that you really think about your career and other examples that you can use to demonstrate your ability, not just talk about it, but show that capability. It's really worked well for Amazon in getting a good cultural match and a good fit. I mean, you see people who've been here for, you know, decades. I think they do a really nice job. We do a really nice job in that interview process.
Those are very great examples. The bar raiser, I think that's resonates on so many levels with how we also I try to structure some of my interviews where everyone has to vote whether they say it's a wow. If it's not a wow, then we probably pass on that particular candidate, where everyone has to agree that in a sense that is the bar being raised if that particular candidate joins our team. So that's very fascinating. And I love the behavioral screens and some, you know, the types of questions that you guys ask, in a sense to be able to really understand kind of the level of thinking and how deep does the person go into analyzing the particular situation. I think you were very generous with that information. So for any of our listeners who are going to be interviewing with Sandy's team, you guys have a little bit of insider information there. Sandy, when it comes to career advice and recommendations, I realize that it's a very loaded and broad question. But it's been interesting to me, especially, you know, my wife, she's in technology, my sister's in technology. I have a lot of women, you know, that surround me that we all work in the same space. In terms of your advice that you would give to, you know, Sandy would give an advice to 21 or 22 year old self when we're first starting out. And also the reason I asked that question is because a good portion of our listeners are early stage career professionals. A lot of them are women in technology. What are some of the areas that you would highlight, at least to yourself, when you were first starting out in your career journey?
Well, the first thing I would say is take more risk. I know that especially a lot of women, they'll look at a job and they're like, oh man, this is like my dream job, but I only have 9 of the 10 qualifications. Whereas a lot of times a guy will come in and he's got 4 of the 10 and he's like, oh, that's good enough. I'll learn the rest. Let me go for it. So I would say first, you know, take those risks. If I was looking back and I had to think about, you know, the number one thing I would say is take the risk. Take the risk in jobs, take the risk with, you know, relationships, take the risk in your, you know, delivering on your dreams, just take more risk. I wish I had taken more risk in my career, and I'm doing more and more and more as I get more experienced as I go along. But that would be probably the first thing I would say. The second one is network, network, network. And John, I know a lot of people say this. I've recently created a class on how to network, because that's really the big thing. Everybody kind of knows, yeah, you know, you gotta network, but how do you do that? So for example, some of the things I recommend is a lot of women, me included, you know, we have so much work to do and we feel like, okay, if we get this done, people will recognize it, but we forget that that personal element matters. So I encourage people to take one day a week and go have lunch with someone. Consider that part of your job, not just an extracurricular activity, but it's really important that you get to know your team and you really understand who they are as a person. Last night, I had a business dinner and we spent, of the 3 hours we were there, all but 15 minutes on the personal stuff. And I think by the time we got to the business stuff, it was so much easier to relate and to want to help each other out because of what we had just talked through. So that would be another one. Make sure that you're networking. So take risk and network. And then my third one would be create your opportunities. I know when I got selected to do some work with AI and ML, it didn't just happen by mistake. I had studied AI and ML in college. I had taken a couple of classes so that I was up to date. I was creating my own machine learning model. So when something opened up, I was ready for it. And so I always encourage people, learn and be curious throughout your career. You're never done learning. Continue to learn, and those opportunities, you'll create your own opportunities based on what you're great at. So those would be my three: create your own opportunities, network, 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 and take more risks.
I love these. I was personally taking a lot of notes as you were talking about, especially on the networking side, because it's such a difficult area to get good at, because we hear a lot about these opportunities to network, but when it actually comes to executing, it's a completely different space. It's very challenging, and I would imagine for women as well. So that's very interesting. And when it comes to creating opportunities, one quote that I actually have this as my tagline on my personal Instagram, it says, create your luck, don't just believe in it. And, you know, in a sense, especially in sales and business development that I had to learn how to get good at as a builder, in a way that every no is a one step closer to a yes. And the harder you work, you know, the luckier you get. Things like that, they definitely resonate. So I think that the recommendation you had when it comes to creating opportunities for yourself, very, very valuable advice. The last portion of every episode, I love to focus on your personal sources, your content diet. What do you consume on a daily basis to self-educate, to self-actualize with so much information being thrown at us? I'm always fascinated at other people's methods to be extremely selective, where you let your mind be exposed to. Can you share some of your thoughts there?
Yeah, I'd love to. So I am a voracious reader. Sorry, I read like everything I can possibly get my hands on. One of the things I do too to relax is I read a lot of fiction, and in particular murder mysteries. And I find that when I do that, it actually helps me with problem solving, because as you're reading some of these mysteries, you have to figure out what's going on. So it's kind of relaxing. It lets your brain relax, but you're still kind of working. You're still solving problems. The other thing that I do is I read lots of leadership books. And I also read a lot online. So I'm a voracious LinkedIn reader. I look at, you know, all the stuff that are going on in Clubhouse, and I try to listen to some of those. Those have been really insightful, different ways of thinking about things. Anything that links to trends and insights, and I try to bring those into our business. So like yesterday, for example, someone published an article on the top 10 new startups in healthcare in Europe. And I read the article and I was like, wow, how many of those 10 are on AWS? Do we need to do something to get them on AWS? I was also reading that Deloitte report that talked about how many people today are looking for meaning. I sent that out to our recruiting team, and my manager is saying, you know, as you're interviewing, talk about the goal and the purpose and what we bring to the table, because this really matters. So I think kind of staying on top of it, and I read throughout the day, is I think a very, very wise move. And then of course I read, you know, books on leadership too. I like Malcolm Gladwell's books a lot. As well as kind of new tactics that are coming up. I read books on marketing, on sales strategies, the Little Red Book of Sales, for example. I read on, you know, partner ecosystem. So I just voraciously consume content in any form or fashion that I can find it, whether that's online, social media, or even that hardcover book.
That's great. And you couldn't have set me up for the last question that I always ask. What is one book that you always recommend to others, and why is that?
Yeah, one of the books, now I just recently found it. I don't know why I just recently found it, because I know it's been a top seller for a number of years. It was written by Andy Grove at Intel, and it's called High Output Management. And the reason I really love that book is it really focuses on the how, not on the what, you know, what you should do, but how to do it. And that's the kind of books I like. And this really focuses on how to get your teams looking at not the end process. I held this many meetings. I talked to my partner this many times. I met with a customer, but really focus on what was the output of what you did in a motivational and inspirational way. So that's probably my new fave that I always ask people to look at and read.
I love that recommendation, and I'm definitely adding this to my growing list of books on my Amazon list. So I definitely appreciate that recommendation, and for our listeners, we'll make that available in the show notes. Sandy, I can't thank you enough for your time today. Very insightful conversation. As I was making comments around me taking copious notes throughout our conversation, which rarely happens, because you were very generous with your advice. And with the podcast, it's always challenging because a lot of times the conversation tends to go into all kinds of direction because it's all audio. So I definitely appreciated, you know, being very concise and compartmentalizing responses with, you know, backing up with great examples, which made it very easy to consume. So I thought that was exceptional. And what I love doing with a lot of my guests is doing a follow-up episode in about a year. Not that we're not going to talk throughout the year, but doing another recording in the year to revisit the conversation from a year ago, see everything that we had talked about, if that still applies, and what are the different areas that we want to cover next. So I'm definitely looking forward to doing that with you, Sandy.
Oh, that sounds great, John. Thank you so much. And thanks to everybody who listened out there. You can follow me on LinkedIn or Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Clubhouse. If you do have questions, John, I'd love for folks to reach out to me.
Well, thank you so much, Sandy. I really appreciate your time today, and we're definitely going to speak soon.
Okay, great. Thank you, John.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.